Hello and welcome to the World Cinema Film Club. I'm your host, as always, Edward Jones, and joining me, of course, is my co-host, the Professor, Mr. Stephen Palmer.
Hola.
Tonight, we look at The Spirit of the Beehive, the 1973 Spanish drama directed by Victor Onsri, and not the Philadelphia band of the same name. This is a pick of yours, Stephen, which I think will become real clear once we get into this film, because if you're not familiar with this, this film is actually considered a masterpiece of Spanish cinema, with people citing it amongst it as being so influential, including directors such as Guillermo del Toro, who cited it as a key influence of both The Devil's Backbone as well as Pan's Labyrinth. The film itself focuses on a young girl named Anna, who has a fascination with the 1931 American horror film Frankenstein, while at the same time dealing with her family life and life in a small village in Spain. So, Stephen, what made you want to talk about Spirit of the Beehive?
It's all on me. It's all on me. All right, well,
this felt like a very you pick.
Well, it did, although I can't claim too much credit because I had other films in mind.
Yeah.
But whilst we were recording the last episode, you did talk about that Empire 100 Best World Cinema films, and I was looking through it as we were talking. And I thought, this is a film I've heard of, and I was aware of, and I was aware how important it was to Del Toro. And I thought, oh, that will be a good one. And I have to admit, I was expecting a slightly different movie. I was expecting something with a few more lashings of magical realism going on. But I did enjoy it. It just wasn't the movie I thought it was. And it's only taken me 50 years to find out.
I'm really not too sure because I certainly had the name Spirit of the Beehive in the back of my head, and I wasn't sure it was the film or the band that placed it in there. But, I mean, obviously prior to doing this film, I mean, he had done two films prior to this as a writer. I mean, there's obviously... I'm trying to figure out what these other films are, because obviously you've got El Ser and you've got El Sol del Membrero.
Yeah, so up until this year, he'd only ever made two proper feature films, which was The Spirit of the Beehive and El Ser. Everything else is like short films and documentaries.
Yes.
But I think this year he has made one with Close Your Eyes, which he's done with... what's the fella called? Oh, it doesn't matter. But yes, I think that's the only drama he's had. So he's got this really tiny back catalogue. Yeah. Both Spirit of the Beehive and El Ser are considered classics of cinema.
Yeah. I mean, certainly while he's obviously a director who's got his fans, for myself, he's certainly not one that has ever sort of like... come across on my list at all. I've never really sort of thought, well, I've got to go and see more of his work. And I think certainly after seeing this film, I can't say that attitude has really sort of changed at all. With the film itself, I mean, this is set in 1940, just after the end of the Civil War. And his viewpoint with creating the film is that basically the poorer people are, the more freedom that they have. And to that extent, he sets it in a small village. I mean, this village is really sort of like poor. It couldn't even be described as sort of like a farming village, because all the farmland surrounding it is all basic. It's like we're back on the frozen tundra that we were with Leningrad Cowboys once again, really, wasn't it? So, because the only sort of farmland around is this old abandoned shepherd's house. Everyone else... sort of does something in the village, but it's a very sort of basic existence that they live. So much so that the only sort of culture they have is that when the mobile cinema comes to town, which is this big cultural happening which sort of gathers the whole village together, and we have this wonderful sequence at the start of the film where all the villagers are turning up, and they all bring their own stools, because they don't have like a proper cinema, so everyone turns up with their own little stools to sit and watch Frankenstein in this rapt fascination. And it's reminded me a lot of The Dreamers in a way, in the way that it showed like how the French would like appreciate cinema and how they all want to like sit as close as they can so they can get those images like first of all. And we certainly see the two sisters here, and Anna in particular, just fascinated by the imagery that's on the screen here of the original Frankenstein, which I think is such an interesting choice of film to tie the film together with.
Yeah, so I think for the setting, it's sort of a very, I think the word is bucolic, isn't it, that you use, saying it's of the countryside, but it's a very barren, bucolic existence. Like you say, and I think there's a reason for that, which we'll get into later, but it also reminded me, you know, with that mobile cinema coming to town, of similar scenes, albeit with a fixed cinema in Cinema Paradiso.
Yes, of course.
Where you get that, the whole village, the whole town come to watch together as a communal act. And what I found fascinating, obviously this is the 1931 Frankenstein, and the pivotal scene for this movie is actually a scene that a lot of Western people won't have seen because it was censored for many, many, many years. So I guess there's an irony here that in this this is the early years of the Franco dictatorship, and again, I'll talk about the Spanish Civil War and my relationship with it. Don't worry, I'm not Ernest Hemingway. I didn't go and fight in it or anything. in that a place in a society that was severely subject to censorship and things like that. The key scene in this film is actually a scene which was censored elsewhere. Which is the sort of the famous scene where Frankenstein accidentally kills a girl. And as you say, this really affects Anna, who's marvelous. Anna has got the most amazing eyes, hasn't she? This childlike wonder and innocence in these huge eyes that she's just absorbing it all in. And she's got a slightly older sister who's a little cowbag.
Right, Isabel,
that's right.
Her whole family is just very dysfunctional, though, because when we have the introduction of the family, we've got the father who's writing about his beehives, we've got the mother who's writing to her lover, who we never see, deceased, constantly sending the letters off, and they're almost like little vignettes of their own. These could be like three separate stories that we have, and it's only when the father calls to the mother and the mother calls to the children, we realise, oh wait, they're all part of the same family, but the way they're introduced perfectly replicates like the structure of this family. They're very disassociated with each other. They all sort of like just do their own thing. They just all happen to live under the same roof.
I mean, I do not think all four of them appear in any scene in the movie.
Well, we have the scene where they're sitting around the breakfast table.
That's right. Yeah, but I think that's
it, that's about it, really, isn't it? So
yeah, but I think, I mean, this film is a. This is going to be the most up my own arse thing I've ever said, but this film is a bit like a poem in that everything appears to be laden with meaning. So there isn't a lot of plot here. Right, there isn't a lot of story here, but everything does seem to be full of symbolism or metaphor for what is going on in Spain at the time. In 73, when the film was released, this was still under Franco's. Spain was still under Franco's dictatorship, and we see this in a lot of films. Obviously. You've mentioned Del Toro's Devil's Backbone, which I think this film clearly influenced, and Pan's Labyrinth, but even like more recent films like by Almodovar, I think, is it Parallel Mothers? Is that the one where they are still going on about the sort of the dead, that the people that were killed during the early days of the Civil War, and they're trying to sort of get their graves recognised. Anyway, it deeply affected it, and obviously it's sort of the great 20th century, late second half of the 20th century thing that happened in in Western Europe that feels crazy and mental. But yes, I think you know, the family are representative of how fractured Spain is. So they are a family, they are Spain, but some people are looking to some former lover, which may have been the rest of Europe. Some people are sitting there doing their own thing, like messing around with their funny little glass beehive, and the kids are just innocents trying to understand this world. And a lot of what I've seen other people talk about is very much that this film is really from the children's point of view, as particularly Anna's point of view, which maybe is why we don't see the family unit together, or people really do things outside of Anna's purview. We do get moments like the mother writing the letters and posting the letters, and we do get the father, you know, messing around with his beehives and falling asleep at his desk and stuff like that. But we don't really see people interact because we're only seeing what Anna sees.
Definitely so, and it's unusual in the fact that this is a film shot completely from the child's perspective. I mean, there's only really a handful of films which actually take this approach. I mean, you obviously got like Truffaut's 400 Blows, for example. There's a couple of Australian New Wave movies as well that also take this sort of weird look where it's sort of like just completely from the child's perspective. And I think it's certainly adds a new angle. If we're just shooting everything from the child's perspective, we're not having cutaways to adult interactions. We're just keeping this purely in that sort of child perspective. I think it really sort of adds this interesting angle, certainly in a setting like we have here. But at the same time, this is a film which is introducing ideas. Everything's all about foreshadowing, but it's nothing ever really has a conclusion to it. Like, even the opening of the film, which is a series of children's drawings, is all essentially foreshadowing what is going to happen in the film. But it's only once we've seen the film and we come back to it again that we can say, all these things are going to come and happen in the film. And I think this is one of my main issues I had with the film, is the fact that it is so abstract, which I know a lot of people, there's people out there who are going to absolutely love the fact it is so abstract and it's so arty, whereas myself, I just wanted a little more substance there. It's all great having all these like great ideas of like putting things out there, but at the same time, it's sort of like, well, I would like some form of plot or a story to follow rather than just watching these girls wander around a barren farmland where they basically, the highlight of their entertainment is waiting for a train to come. That basically seems to be the high point of their existence. And even that, I think I got a little anxious because it's a couple of kids next to a very real train track.
I was having flashbacks to those public safety films.
We're like little Jimmy.
Yeah, I was like, Jesus, don't get too close. I thought I'd when you see trains, it's either public safety films, or Jenny Agutter in a Knickerbockers trying to flag down the railway children's. Yeah. That's my whole train cinema thing. I disagree a little bit. I think there is a story here. It's just very broad, you know. Anna. And this is the story of Anna, and these are some formative years for her, and her sister's a little cowbag to her, like pretending to be dead or telling her things that monsters are real and they live in farmhouses. And she's got a mother and a father that are maybe aren't connected with each other as they should be. And we've just been through a war, so we don't really know how that happens. And they do stumble upon a soldier. But not really much happens because out it. I think really it is a study in childhood. So that moment with the train, for example, they're tiny next to that train, and it just makes you think of when you were a child. Do you remember when we were a child and everything was bigger? Like the chocolate bars are bigger and the bags of crisps are bigger and people are bigger and
you're sounding like everybody's free now, isn't it? It's all like, and when you get older you're fantasized that prices were low, politicians are honorable, and children respected right. Well, their elders.
We do I mean, I'm of that age, I will start talking like that. But I think there is something to it that the world, as a child, we are quite innocent and naive, obviously, but things are bigger and things are scary. And I still take things now that I was scared of as a child that I wouldn't be scared of now, but I still have these sort of, we have these memories, don't we, of, I don't know, a TV show or a movie which scared the shit out of us back then. And then when you see it now, it's like, oh, that was a bit silly of me, wasn't it? But I think that's what this story's like. We've got to always see everything through Anna's gaze. And it's not even a long period of time, is it? It's only a couple of weeks. The film sort of seems to take place over, doesn't it?
It is. It's also not a long film, but it certainly felt longer than it was. So I will give it that. And I mean, you mentioned already, I mean, obviously about the soldier that you find in the sheep fold. And up until this point, her sister Isabel has said that, you know, that Frankenstein's monster's real and she knows where he lives. She sends her down this whole path of like believing that he's like living out in the sheepfold. So that when she encounters the soldier, it's sort of like, oh, you know, it's all coming together, because she has this ongoing fascination with Frankenstein's monster.
Yeah. Her sister basically tells her that the film isn't real, but that Frankenstein and so on are spirits, and if she speaks to the spirits they will come. And so yeah, when she comes across this guy, and this guy, you know, with his big soldier feet that are massive, you know, the footprint that he leaves is massive compared to her little feet, and he's like Frankenstein in that sense. And again, all back to that scene by the riverbank with Frankenstein and the little girl that he accidentally kills. You know, this massive, scary, big creature, which could represent all kinds of things, I imagine, in Arice's mind. But yeah, I mean, we keep going back to Isabel, mate.
She is probably the most key point here. I mean, the fact is that she's got more going on for her than Anna really does. Anna is basically reacting to things around her, where Isabel is finding ways to constantly amuse herself, whether it's sort of like playing dead, or we have that scene where her and her friends are jumping through the fire.
Which is beautiful. I think that's a... I mean, I don't think this is a film where we're going to say, oh, the cinematography, but I do love that.
No. The cinematography is absolutely stunning, and this was handled by Luis Corrado, who was actually losing his sight when he was directing the film, which brought to mind, when I found out that fact, Eat, Drink, Man, Woman, where the chef's like losing his sense of taste, and the idea of that you're losing the one thing that is your trade. So obviously for cinematography, to lose sight would be devastating, in the same way that for a chef to lose taste would be devastating. So I found it so... There's something... something that sort of resonated with me about that fact. But it's certainly, the film itself is very sort of stunningly, it's very stunningly short, especially those opening sort of scenes of them in the mobile theater. I thought those were some of my favorite moments. But whenever we get to see the barren wastelands outside this village, it sort of became a little more depressing. And even when we had the soldier introduced, he's introduced and she has a little interaction with him, and then next minute he's shot by the local police. And there's no sort of like build-up at all to it. It's just like goes to night and then we see gunfire and then he's gone.
And again, there's that whole life during wartime stuff, which I always dig. That how must it be to be a child when this kind of violence is going on, but you're not really part of it, and you're just sort of you're slightly bisecting with it. But after Isabel, so I just back to where I was going with it. She did make me think of you when she nearly strangled her cat to death.
Yeah, okay. Well, that's real nice, isn't it?
No. Let's just be clear. I'm not saying that Elwood tortures cats, but his cat tortures him.
She does. She wants nothing to do with me until we start recording, and then my leg becomes a scratching post. Or one of the other studio cats will get on the table and knock the equipment over. So if you've listened to anything in our back catalogue, you probably heard the cats or heard them knock things over. So, yes, the idea of throttling the cat.
But Isabel she's clearly a year or two older than her sister, and she's a little bit wiser, and she's a little bit evil, as I think some young kids are, and she's pushing the boundaries of, you know, trying to work out what the boundaries are. And it's not as if they've got a lot of role models, is it? So the mother appears distracted at best, the father utterly distracted by things. They don't seem to play a lot with the kids at school, although there was a little bit of it. Also, school seems a waste of freaking time. That whole stick the body part on the giant cardboard cutout is like the most rubbish lesson I've ever seen. and of course it's such a small country, sort of rural school, there's kids of all ages in the same class. I never really understand how that works. But I liked Isabel, and I like Anna, and that scene that you were talking about where Isabel and some of her friends are jumping through the fire. Again, it's Anna's eyes are these big, wide, childlike eyes, and she doesn't really interact, but she's watching all the time, taking it all in. And even through the events of the film, doesn't seem to learn very much. She still seems to be this innocent and naive creature at the very end as well, if not more so.
That's another thing with the film. I mean, nothing ever really sort of changes. We get all this very pretty cinematography, and we have scenes such as like the fact that the children live in this basically a manor house, so they have like the biggest house in the village, and the windows of her father's office are hexagonal, so they look like the combs of a beehive. So it all plays into this this idea, and this title itself is nonsensical. It has nothing to do with the film. It's just something the director heard. It was like a poem, and he thought, oh, that sounds nice and intriguing. I'll make that the title of this film, and then have people years later try and figure out how it links to anything in the film.
I did wonder. I mean, obviously there is the father has something I've never seen before, like this sort of an indoor beehive, for want of a better word. It's a beehive. He just keeps it indoors.
Yes, it's like a glass beehive, isn't it?
Yeah,
which he uses as an analogy for society.
Indeed, and he talks about that. And again, just got to remember this sort of period of time. But the, as you say, the sort of windows of the place also have the same. They're sort of yellowy and they're hexagonal, and they look like that. The family are also like the bees in the beehive as well. But I guess, again, that's me doing potentially some retrospective. Ah, that's what he was going for when the director's literally said, nah.
Certainly when it comes to evaluating this film, I think a lot of people are sort of like reading between the lines, and I think that because the film is so open to interpretation, because there is no real sort of plot through line here. As I say, it's just all foreshadowing that we have here. We have ideas thrown out there, but nothing ever reaches a conclusion, and film just essentially just ends, which I found it, I mean, as I said, I found the experience kind of frustrating, especially for such a short film. I mean, this is 97 minutes, but it felt like it went on a lot longer. And I certainly, with no real plots to like latch onto, I did sort of struggle to get into this. And while we can obviously look at the end where Anna, she goes through this whole experience, and at the end she feels like it appears that she's sort of locked in. And normally how they deal and help very traumatized children is through art therapy, so they have them draw the things which have traumatized or scared them. And in that way we can see those drawings at the start of the film, so everything comes back around again. So if you were to watch this film again, you would feel like a continuation of the film. We're just obviously watching the same events, but obviously we're getting to see those drawings that she would have essentially done, which the first time we watch it just act again as foreshadowing for the events that will happen throughout the course of the film. But we won't obviously know that on a first viewing. It's only on repeat viewing that you can appreciate those little details that are thrown into the film, and kind of makes me feel that Imreese had sort of intended the film to be watched more than once, although I can't really say it's a film that I'm going to be rushing out to sort of rewatch again.
I was going to ask you, but I think you're right, and I think I'll go back again. This film feels a bit like a poem, and that I think there's a lot of stuff here which is metaphor and imagery, and so much so, in fact, it's meant to be a criticism of the Franco regime, or a sort of a love letter to Spain, but at this sort of broken Spain that's a horrible place, and the fact that this apparently is so obvious to everybody that he thought it would never get released abroad, and that the Franco government said that they either didn't see all these criticisms because they were too subtle for them, but they said something along the lines of, oh, we'll let it go to film festivals abroad because it's only 90 minutes long and the plot's so slight, no one will care about it. And actually it became, you know, it's a incredibly well-regarded piece of world cinema, so the kind of rebounded on them. And I think, so I'll just go into my relationship with the Spanish Civil War. So it's a, you know, a bit like on the other show, I always say I love Shanghai in the 20s. I think sort of Spain during the sort of in the aftermath of the Civil War, and generally within Franco's reign, is sort of period of history I love. So much so is that during my A-level history, mate, I spent 2 years studying the history of medicine and the Tudors and Stuarts of the United of England and Scotland. And when it came to sat down to my actual exam, or one of my exams, I for some reason answered questions on the Spanish Civil War. And this is why I got an E, because I hadn't studied it at all. But I just know I've been always attracted to it, like a moth to the flame, and it's never ended well for me. But yeah, I think of all the sort of European countries, sort of the history of Spain, or the modern sort of certainly 20th century history of Spain, really always attracts me. And this, I don't know what you think of The Devil's Backbone, but this just felt like so much like The Devil's Backbone, with less creepiness and going on, but I can absolutely sort of place these in villages next door to each other or something like that. That's where I come from. So I enjoyed it clearly a lot more than you did. And I think you're right that it would benefit repeated viewings. I will also echo some people in reply to your Facebook post about it, that it seems such a shame that there's no decent release of it available.
Well, there is a Criterion release for this one,
but it's only an American Criterion, right?
I know it's only an American one, and there's also a Tartan release for it as well.
Which
I know there's a lot of people saying they're waiting for an upgrade in the Tartan on the Criterion release, and I'm sure that once the Criterion released it, there's not much way it's going to get much better than a Criterion, because they really go for it frame by frame and clean it up real nice. But
I guess they're waiting for a Blu-ray or a UHD of it or something, as the cinematography is so pretty. But it's probably unavailable now. It's probably gone out of print, knowing Criterion. But it would be nice, I think, for it to be a little bit more, because it wasn't on Amazon, was it? I think you ended up having to watch it off YouTube. I ended up having to get it by other means. And for a film that constantly rates up, you know, that isn't just that Empire list, which, you know, we may or may, you know, which will, all those lists, we won't relitigate what happened to us before when we talked about one of these lists, but they do err on the side of art films, don't they? Very much so. And
they do, and I think that's what made the Empire's World Cinema list so interesting, the fact that it's not just a bunch of really predictable ones or a bunch of artsy movies, because, as I said, that's where Leningrad Cowboys came from, and I wouldn't certainly class that as an arty picture, nor like an award-winning picture.
I disagree. I'd probably say it is art house, but coming from a completely different tradition.
Yeah, I mean, it's art house in the way that, like, it's an American, it taps into the same vein as the American indie films of, like, Jarmusch and Linklater, rather than, you know, anything like this.
Yeah, I mean, it's coming, yeah, indie's a good word. It's coming out of the sort of the democratization of the ability to make films, because you can fund it on your 15 credit cards and you can buy a thing and you can get your mates to come and help you. That to me, that's a sort of art house. This is coming from the everything's all so bloody worthy and every scene is dripping with imagery and symbolism, and which is what some people mean when they talk about art house as well. But I'd also say, you know, other films we've talked about even on this show, remember that Mexican film, what was it called, New Order?
Yes,
that's an art house film, but with a very visceral and violent, and, you know, it's not dripping with imagery. It's subtle as a tin of fucking Spam, isn't it? But I still think it's very much an art in the art house tradition. It's a wide church, a broad church.
This is available to watch on the Criterion Channel if you live in the States. You can obviously access that streaming service, and it is also available to buy still as a Criterion release, where it's Spine 351 and features a documentary called Footprints of a Spirit, which is also on YouTube. So you can, if you're not in the US, you can obviously enjoy that. Well, as for as folks in the UK, there is obviously the Tartan release that is still kicking around as well, which you can no doubt pick up as well on eBay or wherever you find your used discs, really.
But that'll be 25 years old nearly, that Tartan disc now. So yes, I guess that's what people are after. They're after a nice,
they just want another region 2
upscaled version. And a region 2 would be nice, absolutely.
So, but
well, for me, you obviously could care less about that, but I would definitely.
Well, I feel that if you wanted this same film, I mean, for myself, I would rather watch, like, Devil's Backbone, or if I wanted to see a film, like, from the child's perspective, then I would certainly gravitate towards Celia from 1989, which is the Ann Turner movie, which was, again, as I mentioned already, part of the Australian New Wave, which is a movement which often gets really overlooked. I mean, much like the Spanish Civil War, I mean, how many movies really sort of cover the Spanish Civil War? It's as underserviced really as the Korean Civil War, which obviously had Brotherhood. Del Toro has obviously done a couple of movies within the Spanish Civil War, when we mentioned already Pan's Labyrinth and Devil's Backbone. And for my money, I would say Devil's Backbone feels like a much more effective movie than Spirit of the Beehive. And I think, as I said, it just all purely falls down to plot, and the fact that, you know, it has a clear plot and a through line for it, and has interesting characters, and he has a similar setting, although Devil's Backbone is actually set during the war, I believe, it's not after the war, which Spirit of the Beehive is. And I think, as I say, it's just that sense of isolation that Beehive has, and the abstractness of the whole proceedings, that, you know, perhaps if I could find some time to watch this where I haven't got, like, chaos erupting around me, which, you know, I probably would have been able to enjoy this. So maybe we can, like, catch it at a revival house somewhere. Maybe this, like, comes to the Prince Charles or similar, then maybe I have a completely different view of this.
I do wonder if actually it's one of those films that needs to be seen at the cinema. I think there's something to that, where you're not getting distracted by, The way we consume movies, I think you and I end up having to consume lots of movies in multiple parts, strange parts of the day, sometimes on devices that are smaller than the palm of our hand. Or, do you know what I mean? And I do wonder if you were like the villagers at the beginning of the movie, if you were watching this in the cinema, which is a, you know, where your other senses are dulled and other things aren't going on, whether it would be more interesting. I'd definitely watch a double bill of this and The Devil's Backbone. I'd be up for that.
Yeah. So you are, I know obviously we obviously talk about the importance of screen size, and that's where they stress about the cinema, but for myself, I mean, if you get yourself a laptop and a decent pair of headphones, it's still just as immersive experience. But certainly, I mean, with this one, I mean, I can understand seeing it in like a revival house where you're sitting on a bench covered with a thin piece of fabric where the air is acrid with clove smoke. I mean, certainly it would add an air to this film, perhaps, and maybe I would appreciate it being surrounded by people who are having an experience with this film that I clearly wasn't. And certainly some of the people often, like Gent's Guide, I posted that I was watching this as a first time watch to, and while everyone was like coming out going, like, given the likes, no one could give me like this breakdown of why they loved it so much, which I was like so sorely looking for. I was just looking for someone to just go and explain, like, why do you like this movie so much? Because the Letterboxd reviews are all about the cinematography, the Mumbai ones are just out in the sticks of weirdness and doing their thing, as all Mumbai reviews do. Yeah, I think I'm glad that we got to do a podcast on this one, because it gives me a chance to sort of like lay it all out and just reassemble the pieces into some sort of easy to and some way to follow it.
The irony is, though, that you've now given me context for the children's drawings at the beginning, which I hadn't twigged were her drawings from her therapy.
I have my moments, it's true.
And so now, actually, you've made me like the film more.
Oh, I'm glad.
So I'm not going to rush back to watch it again, right? I don't think it's had... When I watched something like Cinema Paradiso, which was I only watched about a year ago for the very first time, you know, Cinema Shame and all that. I felt much more deeply affected by that than I did by this, right? I you know, talking about it and talking about, you know, how seeing it through the child's eyes, talking about the effects of a fascist dictatorship in a modern Western nation, all those kind of things, you know, that I'm talking about it now, but was I feeling it at the time? I'm not so sure. But I will definitely come back and visit it again. There's no point illegally downloading it if you're only going to watch it once, is there?
Don't start. We've already got enough problems. Like, with saying what about this. If we were like Tarantino or Roger Avery or Joe Dante, who talk all day about, you know, like, yeah, stick it to Amazon, pirate everything, and they can get away with it because, you know, they're cool outlaws. When we said, people come looking for us. There's repercussions, right, when we endorse things like this.
I absolutely, absolutely agree. I'd never ever suggest this. But obviously, I think you have a vague idea, and people should really know that my flat is absolutely full of DVDs, Blu-rays, and you wouldn't steal a car, people came round to me, they'd have a very hard time saying, because I'd buy this in a shot, but I can't. So
plus, if someone puts it on YouTube or archive.org,
it's on YouTube in its fullness. And as our bits, some of the Criterion extras, as you said,
yeah, they always taking it down.
Yeah, but yeah, no one's taken it down. The algorithm hasn't detected that's what it is, and no one who owns the rights to it seems to be wanting to chase it down. I'm guessing it's got a sales order. You know, the reason it's on Criterion is you have that group of people who buy every Criterion release, and that's probably enough for you, isn't it? So I don't know. I mean, I do know. Piracy is bad. Piracy is not a victimless crime, as my DVD watched just before recording this.
Was you wouldn't at shoot a police officer, would you? You wouldn't then take a dump in his helmet and then send it to his family, would you?
Again, there's people who don't know what you're talking about, but... you're referencing the false equivalency of the anti-piracy adverts of that used to be on the front.
I still remember the
British videos.
I still remember the piracy one, and it's the guy at the market, and he's sort of like train spotting. No wonder you can't understand them. They all speak Scottish, don't they? it's like no, the tracking's off. It's like, oh, dodgy tracking that is. It's like. It's like, what sort of person buys a video at the market and then goes back the next week to complain with the guy, let alone expect the guy to still be there?
I remember going to Crawley used to have a market. I think it was Saturday or Sunday, I can't remember, but we used to go there and there'd be shit like that being sold all the time. Knock-off computer games and video cassettes. Yeah, happy days. And then I went to Thailand and bought a whole bunch of dodgy DVDs there, which I bought 10 back, right? I don't know if you're going to keep this in the show, but I bought 10 back, all Western films, right? And this'll date when I was there. One of them I bought back was Shrek 2. That DVD-R was perfect, right? Other movies I bought back, 8 of them didn't play. And the 10th one, it was like 10 for 100 baht, which is like nothing. This one was a long-forgotten Uma Thurman film called My Super Ex-Girlfriend or something.
Oh, yeah, that's still on Channel 4.
Yeah, well, all the chapters were recorded out of order. You couldn't even watch it. It just jumped around random. I don't even know the effort you would have had to have gone to create this thing was something. Yes, I think I got Aliens versus Predator. That's that will date it, but utterly unplayable. All of them, they just wouldn't even start up on any DVD or any DVD player or computer or anything I had, apart from Shrek 2, which was perfect, which is probably the only decent film of the bunch. Anyway, there we go, we've had a little view down into piracy, which we don't condone at all, do we, Elwood?
No. Support your libraries.
Mm.
As in proper libraries, not like pirate libraries. you know, the ones filled with books and dusty periodicals and homeless people. Anywho, anything else you want to talk about in this one?
And microfiche machines. They must still be in public libraries.
Microfilms.
Well, you know, like microfiche.
Yeah.
So when I did my degree, right, there wasn't an internet. Sorry, children, but there wasn't an internet. And so if you wanted to read those periodicals, so in my degree, I had to go and look at, like for my dissertation, I had to reference all sorts of obscure periodicals and magazines, and they were all on microfiche, and newspapers were all on microfiche. And then I think microfilm is just another word for it. And then there'd be like this viewer. So you'd get out 1963's News of the World that were all scanned in.
You were looking at page 3, weren't you?
No, I wasn't. But that now I'm thinking, but where has all the microfiche and microfiche viewers gone? Because that's what libraries, every library had one or two of them. So I get it. It's all now on the internet, or everything's been scanned in and everything's on a worm drive somewhere. That's dated me as well, but this was only 1989 to 92. I was at university and they had microfiche machines then. Where are they now? I want to know. And if you can point me at one on eBay. Anyway, enough of this. What are we watching next week, mate?
So next week we've got another art house movie for you, because why stop at just one? We're actually going to be taking a look at the films of Gaspar Noé. who's another the infantrybler of recent times. We're looking at his 2009 film, Enter the Void, which is a film I've never seen. And I've seen a couple of Gaspar Noé movies, but at the same time, there's a number of his films which I've always wanted to watch and never got around to, and Enter the Void is certainly one of those. So we're going to be looking at that on our next episode.
Interesting. So I have not seen Enter the Void. I'm glad you didn't choose Irreversible.
I mean, yeah, Irreversible would be like, would be sort of like the standout there, or we could do a Climax, which is also fun as well. But we're going to do Enter the Void because I don't think it really gets talked about too much.
No, I think, though we're, I don't know what your history of drug taking's like, but if I remember this film, I haven't seen it, but I'm aware of it, and I believe we will know what it's like to be on off our fucking heads.
It's a psychedelic movie, which is another appealing aspect.
It is. The bits I've seen, yes, absolutely. This is an this sounds like one that I would pick rather than one that you've picked, but I'm looking forward to it.
That's good. So that's obviously coming up on our next episode. Thank you as always for listening. If you haven't done already, please do hit the like and subscribe button wherever you happen to listen to us. And check out our main show, the Asian Cinema Film Club. You can follow us on Facebook and Instagram. We're also on Threads and Blue Sky. So come say hi to us there. And you can check out our full archive episodes at asiancinemafilmclub.wordpress.com. If you could also leave us a review on iTunes, that'd be really appreciated, because reviews help raise our profile on the algorithm, because it is all broken and twisted over there, and we've got to play the game if we want people to see it, and anything we can do to help raise the profile of the show is only a good thing. But until next time, thank you as always for listening. Thanks to my co-host Stephen.
Pleasure as always.
And join us next time for Enter the Void.